Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Many years ago, Riley Knight completed a degree in history. This proved to be a bad move, as it was absolutely useless for him. Until now, here's some half-assed history.
What's going on, mate? Great to have you along for some more half-assed history. This week on the agenda, you're going to get a chat about a bloke named William Adams, who was the first Englishman ever to reach the shores of Japan. He was one of the first people from the Western world to ever become a samurai, and most notably right at the moment in March 2024, he is the inspiration behind one of the main characters in the hit TV show Shogun. Now, I've been watching and greatly enjoying Shogun, as I know many alert listeners have been too, and while this TV show is very much historical fiction, all of its characters are the invention of an author, James Clavell, who wrote the book upon which Shogun is based. Most of the main characters are inspired by real people from real history. And this is one thing that I really like about Shogun, because unlike certain other pieces of historical fiction, Braveheart episode 109, get across it, this TV show and the book that it's based on, they're not trying to pass themselves off as actual history, as actually, you know, what happened in real life. Shogun isn't real history. It's not trying to be. It is a loose adaptation of the stories of some people and events from real history, but it's not playing the very annoying based on a true story card. And I really like that. It's a great TV show. It's a little slow in parts, but still a fascinating depiction of feudal Japan at the turn of the 17th century. And I would say you should give it a watch if that sounds interesting to you. Although I will also say apologies to those listening to this episode in future months and years when Shogun is, you know, no longer the flavor of the month. But look, honestly, the story of the real life story of William Adams is still a very interesting one, even if you haven't or aren't going to watch Shogun. But if you do, with this episode, you'll have a much better understanding of the truth that inspired Shogun's fiction, the real world events that went into the creation of both the original novel and the TV show that's been based on it. Now, interestingly, we've actually already covered a lot of what happens in the show when we talked about the life and times of the most historically notable person represented in Shogun, Tokugawa Ieyasu, episode 232, get across it. He was the inspiration for the character Lord Yoshitora Naga. So rather than talk too much about Ieyasu today, because again, this is ground we've already trodden, I decided that we'll focus on the life of the other main character of the show, William Adams, who is, of course, represented in Shogun as John Blackthorne, the pilot, the first Englishman to ever reach Japan. And I can tell you this, there are more than a few alert listeners who are very keen to hear this, at least. Quite a few people got in touch requesting the story of Adams and the history behind the TV show. Tom Austin, Javier Gonzalez-Sanchez, Emil Neufeld. And there have been other people just more interested in Japanese history broadly, David Schultz, Alyssa. So, as ever, thanks to everyone who's got in touch requesting this sort of stuff, and everyone else who gets in touch every week. It's great to hear from listeners. So, Even if you haven't and aren't going to watch Shogun, the story of William Adams is still a ripper and still should be good fun to get across anyway. Plenty of blood and guts and horrible murder to enjoy, don't you worry. And if you are a fan of the TV show, I do hope you enjoy a little bit of a peek behind the curtain in terms of what happened in history to inspire the story that that's unfolding on your screen. And if you're a new listener that's maybe discovered this show because of their interest in the TV show, welcome. By all means, welcome. There are so many other episodes that may interest you as well, many of which I'll point out as we get through this one. If you hear me reference another episode, you may be able to go back and listen to that one and maybe you'll enjoy that as well. Anyway, let's get into it here. Let's have a chat about William Adams, talk about what he did, where he went, who he met, and just how Shogun has been based on his life and his experiences. We're going all the way back here. We're going all the way back to the 24th of September, 1564, to a little English town called Gillingham, or maybe is it Gillingham? After the Elgin Marbles catastrophe, I really don't want to be. I don't want to nail my colours to the mast in one way or the other. Anyway, this is where William Adams was born, and you almost certainly know what I'm going to say next, of course, because I say it so often when we are opening the story about people like this from history. We don't know too much about his early life. We do know that his old man died when he was just a youngster, very sad. And at the age of 12, as a result of this, as a result of losing his dad, he was apprenticed to a shipbuilder in London. And Adams seems to have made the most of this opportunity, not just learning the art of shipbuilding, but also many other important maritime skills too, most notably navigation. And on the back of these skills, he joined the Royal Navy, the English Royal Navy, I should say, at the age of 24 during the Anglo-Spanish War. Although I guess I should be a little more specific here, because there have been a lot of Anglo-Spanish wars over the years. The one I'm talking about here is the one fought between 1585 and 1604. One of the more famous ones, for sure, because it was this one that featured the Spanish Armada, episode 35, get across it. Even if you've never listened to that episode, I bet you've heard of the Spanish Armada, but you may not have heard of some of the truly absurd stories that emerged from this attempt that that Spain made to invade England. Anyway, Adams actually took part in seeing off the Spanish Armada on the side of the English, although not in a particularly exciting fashion. He was the master of a supply ship. So important, yes, but exciting, no. But hey, he was there, still counts. Interestingly, during his time in the Royal Navy, Adams also sailed under Sir Francis Drake, the famous explorer and, I guess depending on whom you ask, pirate or privateer. I think he probably preferred the latter term there. We'll have to get around to doing an episode on Drake one of these days. There's a lot going on with his story. I'll add him to the list. I'll get there eventually. In 1589, Adams got married. He married a woman named Mary Hyn? H-Y-N. I got no idea. Should have looked that up. Didn't. Doesn't matter. And together, these two, they had two kids, John and Deliverance. But sadly, Adams wasn't actually around in the lives of his kids all that much, or his wife's life, for that matter, because when both of his kids were still very young, he took up employment in the English Barbary Company, working as a pilot. So he was always off at sea. Now, pilot, obviously, these days you think about a pilot flying a plane, but a ship's pilot is more or less exactly what you'd guess it to be. It's the person who steers a ship, particularly through dangerous or treacherous waters. These days, pilots work locally, right? They help large visiting ships navigate local waterways, harbours and rivers, that sort of thing. Pilots are prized for their specific knowledge of certain areas, right, in avoiding hazards and the like, able to bring a ship into port through waters that, as I say, may be a bit treacherous. Anyway, Adams, he worked for the Barbary Company, sailing back and forth between England and Morocco, mainly for the benefit of the cloth and the sugar trade. And this seems to have been what he did for most of the 1590s, until we reach 1598, when Adams made a decision that would change his life forever. And ultimately, in, 400 years' time, result in a breakout TV hit. So, good on you, Adams. You've done us all a favour by deciding to do what you did. In 1598, Adams, who's now in his mid-30s, he decided that he wanted to sail farther away than ever before, away from Europe and away from North Africa and all the way to Asia. Now, The Dutch had strong trading links in Asia, and they also had strong political links with the English. They were both Protestant nations who were allied together in their fight against Spain, and you can hear more about that fight against Spain, not just in episode 35, the Spanish Armada, Get Across It, but also in episode 68 and 69, the 80 Years' War, Get Across Them as well. So many absurd stories still come out of that conflict as well. Such as, for instance, I guess I'll give you an example, just if you want a hook to go and check out those episodes. For instance, the time that pirates called the Sea Beggars surfed across farmland on their ships to break a siege after deliberately breaking seawalls to cause a flood. So, again, episode 68, 69, Get Across Them. Anyway, the Dutch and the English, obviously very good mates at this stage. They're allied against the Spanish. And Adams, therefore, was able to easily find work with a Dutch merchant company owned by a bunch of wealthy blokes from Rotterdam. This was an early precursor to the mighty Dutch East India Company, which we'll feature very briefly later on in this episode. And while working for the Dutch, he was employed as a pilot. He was employed as a pilot on one of five ships that were sent off by this Dutch merchant company. And the goal that they had was to sail southwest from Europe to the Strait of Magellan, which you can learn all about in episode 106, The First Circumnavigation of the Earth, Get Across It. This strait is at the bottom of South America. It connects the Atlantic to the Pacific. And the plan was for the fleet to sail to the strait and then through the strait and then into the Pacific Ocean and across the Pacific all the way to Asia, pick up a bunch of spices and make an absolute fortune selling them all the way back in Europe. And this was a risky maneuver for this Dutch fleet to undertake because, as you may know, much of South America was under the control of the Spanish, who, as I've said, were at war with the English and the Dutch at this stage. And the parts of South America that weren't under the control of the Spanish were under the control of the Portuguese, who were Catholics and didn't need a war to as an excuse to, you know, go after the Dutch and the English because they were Protestants. So it was going to be a tricky thing to do, sailing into what was essentially waters heavily controlled by Catholic nations, by belligerent Catholic nations for this Dutch fleet. But they set off all the same. And, to cut a long story short, this expedition was an absolute catastrophe. It was a total disaster from the immediate outset, in fact. Have a listen to this, right? After leaving in June in 1598 and sailing as far as Northern Africa, right, the fleet's leadership realized that they had miscalculated how long their stores and supplies would last. They realized that they had, in fact, been overfeeding their crews. Now, it was going to be a difficult thing to pull into a Spanish port and restock with supplies, given their nations were at war. So this was a very big problem. And from, as I say, essentially the outset of the voyage, the supplies, the rations that were given to all the crew on board these ships had to be pulled back quite significantly to make sure that they were actually going to last. So obviously the men loved that, of course, having their rations cut after a few weeks, absolutely brilliant, getting off to a great start there. But they had, as I say, enormous difficulty going ashore on the coast of Africa to try to find new supplies before crossing. They essentially had to go and forage, right? And this was something that, you know, ships would do. They would stop off at coastlines where there weren't any towns or trading ports or anything like that and replenish their fresh water from rivers or hunt and forage for fresh meat or whatever else. But, trying to feed five ships off hunting and gathering wasn't going to be particularly sustainable. But it only got worse from there because once the fleet set off again, this time attempting to sail across the Atlantic all the way to South America, a huge number of those aboard the ships got sick. And in fact, the bloke in charge of the whole fleet, a bloke whose name was Admiral Jacques Mahu, he died. He got so sick that he actually died. And so now the bloke who is in charge, right, the admiral, the fellow who was the boss of this entire expedition, he's dead. So this is a bit of a crisis for the leadership of the fleet, who have to figure out who's going to take his place. Not an easy thing to do when, again, half the men that you're commanding are halfway towards death's door. And then the whole fleet, to make it even worse, was blown all the way back to Africa by unfavorable winds. Strong winds blew them all the way back eastward to the African coastline. And then, after arriving there, there was an outbreak of scurvy, then dysentery. So things are really going excellently. The fleet decided, this is a little heartless, right? But also, what a novel approach to solving this problem. The leadership of the fleet decided to just dump all of its sick men off the ships, right, on the coast of Central Africa. Ah, someone else's problem now. And with that done, they had another crack at getting across the Atlantic. But by now, it's 1599. These huge delays have eaten even further through the through the fleet's supplies. So when they finally arrive in Argentina in March, the crews are absolutely starving. Now, happily, they were able to replenish some of their supplies on the other side of the Atlantic, on the Argentinian coast. But then, right, because this voyage has been delayed by so many months, by the time they sail south to the Strait of Magellan, it was winter, right? By the time they get there, it's May going on June, so it's absolutely freezing cold, right? The middle of a southern hemispherical winter, terrible time. They couldn't get through the strait due to the wind and the weather conditions. They're stuck there for months in the Strait of Magellan, and they were reduced to eating like penguins and mussels to try to get themselves through, and countless crewmen died because of this. The conditions were absolutely awful. Until finally August came, and with it a bit more warmth, the weather relaxed a little bit, and they could finally continue on into the Pacific. But again, they are months behind schedule, and things really aren't looking good. But if you'll believe it, again, it only got worse from there, because in September, in the Pacific, a storm separated all the ships. And while details are a bit sketchy at this stage, because the fleet essentially is no more and there aren't all that many people alive on any of the ships, right? All these ships ended up in various places around the world. Some of them went back to the Netherlands. One returned to South America and ran afoul of the Spanish there. Of course, they're still at war, don't forget, so that wasn't a good time for the Dutch who landed there. One of the ships made it to Indonesia, while another one was lost in a typhoon near Hawaii. But the ship that we care about, and the ship that we're going to talk about here, a ship called the Liefde, sometimes also known as the Erasmus, it continued across the Pacific and kept up the fleet's original mission to make it to Asia. Sort of, mainly. Eh. The real reason they were sailing westward towards Asia by this stage was just to get as far away as possible from the Spaniards who controlled the Eastern Pacific, because at this stage, the crew of the Liefde, they really were not in good nick. They could not hold their own against the Spanish. Starvation and disease, storms and misadventure, these had all taken their toll on the Liefde and its crew. Only a tiny fraction of the men who had set out aboard the ship at the start of the voyage were actually still alive. Only 20 or 30 people had actually made it this far. But one of the people who had made it this far was, of course, the ship's pilot, William Adams. And with Adams at the helm, the Liefde made it all the way across the Pacific and arrived on the shores of Japan in April 1600, coming up on 2 years after first departing Europe with Adams and just eight other crew members making it this far.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
But it's here, right, the point at which the TV show actually sort of kicks off properly with Blackthorne's arrival in Japan, that I want to pause and rewind a little bit to talk about the European presence in Japan in the back half of the 16th century so as to set the stage for Adams' arrival. The first Europeans to set foot in Japan were Portuguese. They were Portuguese traders in 1543 who had been blown off course while sailing about. And this accidental encounter that the Portuguese had with Japan, it changed the course of Japanese history forever. It opened up Japan to European trade. And most notably, the most important consequence of Japan entering the global market was the fact that they now had access to gunpowder, a full history of which you can hear about, episode 115, get across it. Japanese armies prior to European contact hadn't fought with gunpowder, but within a decade or so of the Portuguese arriving, hundreds of thousands of muskets were being used by the military forces of various daimyos or feudal Japanese lords in the ongoing civil wars that were plaguing Japan as part of the Sengoku period. The Portuguese were able to secure a steady foothold in Japan. War is very profitable for arms dealers, of course, and so they generated a lot of wealth through trade and commerce with the Japanese. And honestly, that, you know, obviously they weren't just selling guns. They did sell a lot of guns to the Japanese, but the Portuguese, they made a packet selling all sorts of stuff and also buying all sorts of stuff and taking it back and selling it in other places around their global trade network. But the other thing that the Portuguese did in Japan was they introduced Christianity to the nation, and more specifically, Catholicism. And this would have a very significant impact on the cultural and political development of the nation as Europeans became more and more involved in its affairs. Many Japanese people converted to Catholicism, and I don't want to be too cynical here when talking about this, but a lot of very powerful Japanese people converted to Catholicism because it was very profitable to do so. The Portuguese favoured those Japanese lords who converted in their trade deals, right? If you converted to Catholicism as a Japanese daimyo, you had the pick of the bunch when it came to arms shipments and the like. And then, of course, if you were a Catholic, then obviously your followers and the people that were under you, in order to impress you and gain favour with you, they would also convert to Catholicism. Hundreds of thousands of Japanese people converted to Christianity after the Portuguese arrived. And again, I don't want to be too cynical about this because I don't necessarily have the fullest picture of it, but certainly one of the details that emerged when looking into the spread of Catholicism from the Portuguese into Japan was the fact that it was very politically and militarily expedient for a lot of Japanese leaders in order to gain favour with the Portuguese and therefore have greater access to their gunpowder weapons for them to adopt this new faith. So that was certainly an element of the spread of Christianity throughout Japan. But if we're going to talk about the history of Japan in the late 16th century, there is one bloke that we have to mention, and that is, of course, Oda Nobunaga, a daimyo who rose to conquer much of the rest of feudal Japan with the aid of gunpowder weaponry. And for his full story, you can listen to episode 230, get across it. Now, Nobunaga had an enormous impact on Japan and set the stage for future unifiers to bring the entire island nation together. But he didn't get there himself, not quite. He was assassinated in 1583, but his work to unify Japan was continued by another bloke, Toyotomi Hideyoshi, who I talked about in episode 231, get across it. And also remember this bloke because we're going to come back to him in a little bit. He's an important fellow. Both of these leaders, right, both Nobunaga and Hideyoshi, they had to deal with the challenges and take advantage of the opportunities that this expanding European influence in Japan offered. But I say European, really it is just Portuguese, right? It was initially the Portuguese that had the most significant, an overwhelmingly significant presence out of all the European nations in Japan. But interestingly, to bring it back to the TV show here, Shogun implies that the existence and location of Japan was a very closely guarded Portuguese secret. And I'm not sure how true that actually was, because as far back as 1568, maps of Japan had been publicly published. I think that people knew about Japan and they knew that the Portuguese had a strong interest in it. But look, whether other nations knew exactly where Japan was or not, It ultimately didn't matter because it was definitely the Portuguese that had got there first. They had entrenched themselves in Japanese affairs. But that, as we will talk about, would change with the arrival of Adams and the Dutch in 1600. 2 years previously, in 1598, Toyotomi Hideyoshi, the successor to Oda Nobunaga, He died of an illness at the age of 61. Now, technically, his son, Toyotomi Hideyori, was put in charge, but as Hideyori was little more than just a boy, a council of regents was established to rule instead. And after years of tension and strife and full-scale civil war, this was not a sustainable situation, this regency. And it was during this regency period that one of the most important people in Japanese history, Tokugawa Ieyasu, began to make his moves. He gathered his allies and made a play to seize power altogether, going up against his chief rival, Ishida Mitsunari, a powerful governmental official, but not, some listeners may be surprised to learn, not one of the regents that had been appointed by Hideyoshi. Ieyasu was a regent, but Mitsunari was not. Now, why, you may be wondering, would this come as a surprise to many listeners? Because up until that point, right, as I was sort of telling you about the death of Hideyoshi and the consequences of his demise, I was essentially just describing the overarching political plot of the TV show of Shogun, right? Because Toyotomi Hideyoshi, the dying leader that I said before, you should remember, right? That's the Taiko from the show. That's that old bloke in the scene who lay dying, asking Toranaga to protect his son. And Toranaga is, of course, as I said before, none other than Tokugawa Ieyasu, the political and military mastermind who, after the Taiko's death, began to maneuver and take power during the instability of the regency, taking advantage of this political turmoil. However, Takahiro Hira, the main antagonist of the show, the bloke who wanted to impeach and then execute Toranaga, you remember him if you've watched it, he is based on Ieyasu's chief rival, Ishida Mitsunari, who was not a regent, while Hira in the show is. So, as you can see, right, Shogun is more about telling the broad strokes of a story set against a historical background rather than something that is trying to pass itself off as you know, faithfully accurate historical fiction. Something that I have enjoyed a lot in watching this TV show, more so than I do when things are based on real-life history. I think one of the things that's really helped is they've changed all the names of these characters to make you understand that this isn't real, it didn't happen, it may be inspired by history, but it's not a representation of history. But it does take a lot of cues from real-world Japanese history. Even the character of Toranaga himself, very heavily based on Ieyasu in a lot of ways, as you can hear all about in episode 232, Get Across It. Ieyasu spent much of his childhood as a political hostage, which taught him strength and cunning and self-reliance. He, too, grew to become a powerful daimyo, just like Toranaga in the show. He was a regent for Hideyoshi. The two of them were once enemies, interestingly. But again, you can hear about that in those episodes I've already mentioned. Ieyasu built a castle in Edo, modern-day Tokyo, where he consolidated his power and his wealth and his influence before finally getting underway with his political moving and shaking towards the end of the 16th century. And again, in the show, Toranaga, he is explained to have done all of these things. So in terms of background, right, the setting of Shogun is pretty historically sound. But the plot of the show and the role that the characters play in it, this is where the departure from historical reality in its detail takes place, which you'll see as we now return to the story of Adams and his first meeting with Ieyasu. In the TV show Shogun, John Blackthorne is represented as, I don't know how to put it. Again, like a privateer, I guess, if you ask some people, but then a pirate if you ask others, right? The mission that Blackthorne and his crew on the Erasmus had was to go and burn and raid and pillage Catholic settlements across the New World. And as we've talked about when it comes to the real world voyage of Adams, that just isn't true. Adams was... It's funny, in the show, there's that scene where Blackthorne goes, right, let's not get in trouble. We'll just tell them we're merchants. That's what Adams was, right? He was a merchant. Well, he not him specifically, but he was sent on behalf of merchants attempting to forge these trading links throughout the New World. But that's not as exciting as having, you know, a deep, dark secret that is going to come back later on in the show and end up being a, you know, a major plot point or a source of tension and conflict. So you understand why they've taken these liberties. But again, I'm fine with it because it's not trying to pass the character of William Adams off as someone who actually did all this sort of stuff. It's someone who is based on him, very clearly inspired by him, but not an actual representation of him. And these historical departures only become more and more apparent now as we talk about what actually happened to Adams once he landed on the shores of Japan. Although, hang on, Before we go any further, very briefly here, I do actually feel that it's only fair to mention that the story that I'm going to tell you now as we get stuck into Adam's story in the real world, it might, and I don't know if it will, but it might have spoilers for the TV show Shogun. And the reason I don't know if it does or not is because not all the episodes are out yet. I've only watched the first four. I've got no idea that the entire season hasn't been released just yet. But if the show follows the broad sweep of history, then continuing Adam's story here and his role in Iyasu's campaigning against his rivals will probably reveal the ending of the show. Again, I can't be certain. Maybe the show takes its own direction. But I thought it only right to point out that if the show tries to build up a huge amount of tension and drama about the outcome of, I don't know, say the whatever its version of the decisive Battle of Sekigahara is, well, by the end of this episode, you'll know who won in real life. So I guess consider yourself duly forewarned about potential spoilers. I've never been in this situation before. It's like, I'm going to tell you a story that might spoil something. I don't know if it will or it won't. But that is, I think, the warning that I feel it's right to give you. Anyway, Adams. He's aboard the Lifter. It limps across the Pacific and lands on the Japanese shore near Kyushu, the southernmost of the Japanese main islands. And as I mentioned before, it's just him and eight other men who have survived to this point, who have managed to survive the harrowing journey across the Pacific all the way from the Strait of Magellan. On Iyasu's orders, the crew was taken prisoner and they were brought to Osaka, while the ship itself was confiscated and held by the Japanese before eventually sinking, actually, after being sailed to Edo. It was in such bad condition that it really didn't last much longer. But the arrival of the Lifter would go on to be quite a significant event in Japanese history for a few reasons, as you'll see as we talk about it more. Iyasu was no stranger to the strength and the power of European weaponry. He had seen what muskets and cannons could do in open battle. And so he took a great interest in the ship when it arrived because of the power of European weaponry. Aboard the Lifter were hundreds and hundreds of muskets, in addition to 19 cannons, all of which were very quickly plundered from the ship for safekeeping by Iyasu's forces, given the enormous rarity and the shocking power that they had in this part of the world. But Iyasu took an interest not just in the ship, but also in its crew. And as the ranking officer, Adams was brought in front of Iyasu on several occasions. Firstly, to give an account of himself and his men and his ship, but then also to talk more broadly about a great many other things besides. Iyasu wanted to know all about Europe and its politics and people, its kings and queens. He wanted to know about its conflicts and its wars and its religions. And more broadly, he wanted to know about the entire world, its makeup, how it could be traversed, all these things. And of course, he would have had many of these answers given to him already by the Portuguese. But Iyasu was not a bloke who was very quick to trust anyone at all. And so he probably would have found it very valuable to have the perspective of someone else, someone who wasn't pushing the Portuguese agenda on him to answer all of these questions. And so therefore compare and contrast what the Portuguese were saying to him compared to what this other bloke, who had no fondness for the Portuguese as a Protestant, he wouldn't have liked the Catholic Portuguese. And so Iyasu, I'm sure, was very interested to hear Adam's answers to this. And what were Adam's answers? You may wonder. Well, look, it's no use me telling you what they were. We can actually hear from the bloke himself. Here is what he wrote home in a letter to his wife about his encounters with Iyasu in the weeks after he arrived in Japan. Coming before the king, I'll stop you there. Sorry, William, old mate. He's not a king. He's a daimyo. He's obviously a very, very powerful bloke, and I could forgive you for sort of thinking that he might have been a king, but strictly speaking, not a king. Anyway, we'll go back. We'll continue. Coming before the king, he viewed me well, and he seemed to be wonderfully favourable. He made many signs unto me, some of which I understood, and some I did not. In the end, there came one that could speak Portuguese. By him, the king demanded of me of what land I was, and what moved us to come to his land, being so far off. I showed unto him the name of our country, and that our land had long sought out the East Indies, and desired friendship with all kings and potentates in way of merchandise, having in our land diverse commodities, which these lands had not. Then he asked whether our country had wars. I answered him, yea, with the Spaniards and Portugals, being in peace with all other nations. Further, he asked me, in what I did believe. I said, in God that made heaven and earth. He asked me diverse other questions of things of religions and many other things, as what way we came to the country. Having a chart of the whole world, I showed him through the Strait of Magellan. This conversation, it would have been held, as Adams pointed out, through a translator speaking Portuguese. I actually couldn't confirm how much Portuguese Adams actually spoke, but obviously enough to have these conversations with Iyasu. Otherwise, perhaps someone there from Portugal, probably a priest, maybe could have spoken English or perhaps Dutch, and so translated that way. Look, I don't know, but what I can tell you is that this translation was almost certainly not done by a woman named Hosokawa Gracia, the inspiration for Lady Toda Mariko in the TV show. While Gracia is a fascinating figure, I don't know how much she actually had to do with Adams, and I suspect not all that much. Gracia was a noble lady of the Akechi clan, the clan responsible for the assassination of Oda Nobunaga. And like her counterpart in the show, she had converted to Catholicism. And I did mention spoilers before. You know that bit in the show where Mariko is talking about her family's deep, dark secret? Yeah, the character she was based on was an Akechi, the clan responsible for killing the assassination of one of the greatest Japanese leaders that the country had ever seen, Oda Nobunaga. So I imagine probably that's what that particular scene was foreshadowing. Anyway, Gracia herself in real life, she was held as a political hostage by Ishida Mitsunari, Tokugawa Ieyasu's chief rival. And look, yeah, I don't know how much time she spent as a translator for Adams, and certainly she wouldn't have had the time to sit around eating natto with him or you know, watch him get his gear off and go for a midnight swim. But speaking of Catholics, like Gracia, the Catholic Portuguese, they were not pleased when these Protestants turned up on the shores of Japan, and they strongly petitioned Iyasu to have Adams and his crew executed as pirates. Now, why would they want this? Well, firstly, as I've already mentioned, the Portuguese had essentially what was a monopoly on European trade with Japan, and they were worried that a Dutch presence there would disrupt that, something that they ended up being very correct about, as it turns out. But secondly, right, because the Portuguese were Catholics, and these arrivals were Protestant, and that's really enough of a reason for anyone, mates. And, you know, the two nations were at war as well, I suppose, so that's as good a reason as any. But yes, the Portuguese, the Catholics in Japan, they were not fans of Adams and his Dutch crew, and they wanted him executed quick smart. But Iyasu refused. He refused to execute Adams. He refused to execute the crew, as Adams also explained in the letter that I mentioned before, in a letter that he sent home to his wife. We as yet had not done to Iyasu nor to none of his land any harm or damage, therefore, against reason or justice, to put us to death. If our country had wars the one with the other, that was no cause that he should put us to death, with which the Catholics were out of heart that their cruel pretense failed them. Iyasu very clearly recognised the potential usefulness of Adams, and so kept him around. And while the TV show has Adams going here, there and everywhere, piloting ships, training troops, and doing a lot of yelling, weirdly, like, quite a lot. Most of Blackthorne's activities in the show come under fictional storytelling rather than actual history. Because, in fact, apart from bringing Iyasu the cannons and the guns that were aboard the Lifter, Adams didn't actually play much of an active role in the hugely important events that followed his arrival in Japan. In August 1600, the decisive Battle of Sekigahara took place, the point at which this is the very last chance for spoilers here, because I imagine this battle is going to be a major plot point in the upcoming TV show. The Battle of Sekigahara was where Iyasu finally defeated Mitsunari once and for all, and in practical terms, established himself as shogun, and established the Tokugawa shogunate. It wouldn't be until 1603 officially that Iyasu was named shogun. But again, details on this and a lot more can be found in episode 232, Get Across It. Adams, in the meantime, he remained in Japan. It's possible that he may have offered instruction to Iyasu's forces on European weaponry and tactics, but that's far from definite. And he almost certainly wasn't at the Battle of Sekigahara. When it came to the role that the arrival of the Leafter played in that battle, it was definitely the cannons and not Adams and his men that played the more important part. Iyasu was able to use the 19 cannons that had arrived on the Dutch ship to blast Mitsunari's forces to pieces. Again, his adoption of modern European gunpowder weaponry was a very important factor in the battle going his way. But honestly, it wasn't until well after Iyasu was established as shogun in 1603 and beyond that Adams' career as one of the first Western samurai really took off. In 1604, Adams was instructed by Iyasu as shogun to build him a Western-style sailing ship, which were stronger and more advanced than the Japanese vessels at the time. Now, Adams, you'll remember, he was a shipbuilder in his early days, and so he took to this task with an enormous amount of experience and competence. He oversaw the construction of two medium-sized ships for Iyasu, both built in the European style, the very first Western-style ships ever built in Japan. And Iyasu was immensely pleased with these ships that Adams had built him. They were used to chart out the Japanese coastline, and Adams' success in building them ended up winning him a lot of favour with the shogun. Also favoured were the other Europeans who had arrived with Adams. They were given permission to leave Japan. They were so well-liked by Iyasu. And these Dutchmen promptly established trading routes on behalf of their country, making themselves absurdly wealthy very quickly indeed as they began to break up the Portuguese monopoly on the Japanese market. But this was not the fate enjoyed by Adams. He was a victim of his own success. His favour with Iyasu was so high that the shogun didn't let him leave Japan. He wouldn't let him leave his court, his side as an advisor, as someone who was very important to him. And because of how valuable Adams was as an advisor to the shogun, look, there were upsides and downsides to the role that he fell into. Adams lived a life of luxury as a friend, really, of Iyasu. He was paid generously for his services, and ultimately he was raised to the status of samurai. He was presented with the two swords that men of that class would carry around. In European terms, this is essentially like being knighted. And there aren't many Westerners who had this honour bestowed upon them. The title he was given, Hatamoto, or Bannerman, it came with a great many privileges of rank, including a personal fief, a great many servants at his command. Iyasu seemed to not just favour Adams politically, but also personally. He seemed to really like the bloke, because once Adams had learnt the Japanese language, he was also appointed as the shogun's official translator, much to the chagrin of the Portuguese, who, of course, had always been the ones to provide high-level interpreters to the Japanese elite. But no longer. Now it was Adams who was speaking on behalf of the shogun whenever it came to translating things. And the shogun also relied on Adams very heavily for advice and counsel on the Western world, as Japan continued to open up to foreign involvement from the other side of the world, from the Portuguese to the Spanish to the Dutch and the English. Everyone in Europe was very keen to see what could come of accessing this new Japanese market, and all the while, Adams was there to advise Iyasu on how best to proceed. And you can imagine, with this bloke in the ear of the shogun, and essentially also as his mouthpiece while translating, you can imagine that Adams wielded a lot of influence when it came to Japanese foreign affairs. And this will become readily apparent when we talk about some of the things that happened after Adams sort of rose to this high-level position within Iyasu's court. He was a wealthy and respected and quite powerful bloke. But, as I said, there were some downsides to his position. Most notably, of course, that he wasn't allowed to depart Japan. He was more or less a prisoner, honestly, in a nation-sized cage, but a prisoner all the same. He was unable to leave the service of the shogun. And so his wife and children back in England, they received letters from him, and they received money as well. He sent back money to support his family on the other side of the world, but years and years passed with nothing more. He was stuck on the other side of the world. And further, and also kind of sadly, really, Iyasu declared at one point that William Adams, the Englishman, was dead, and that Adams was now Miura Anjin, the pilot of Miura. And even today, Mira Anjin, this is the name that he is better known by in Japan. And for better or worse, Adam seems to have adopted his new name and his new identity. Perhaps he realized that this was just what his life was now, and there was no point trying to resist it. While he still sent letters and money back to England to support his wife and children there, with his new identity, with his new life, with William Adams being declared dead by the Shogun, Adams remarried. He took another wife as Miura Anjin. He married a woman named Oyuki, and they had two children together. But looking past his personal life, Adams, as I mentioned before, he played a very important role in the ongoing development of Japan as it continued to open itself up to a far-flung foreign global trade network. And firstly, right, Adams, the most significant impact that he had on the direction that Japan took in terms of its relations with European nations. Adams, as a Protestant, greatly undermined the reputation and the standing of the Portuguese and Spanish Catholics in Japan. The Portuguese went from essentially being the sole representatives of Europe and European culture in Japan to being almost completely politically and religiously sidelined. Eventually, Catholics would be banished from Japan altogether, and in 1614, they would face persecution at the hands of the Shogunate. So the Protestants really won that round, it seems, and it didn't stop there, because it wasn't just a religious influence that Adams had, it was also an economic one. Thanks to Adams' role within the Shogunate's government, the Dutch East India Company was able to establish itself in Japan at the behest, with the approval of Adams essentially influencing Ieyasu and the Shogunate to allow the Dutch in with open arms. In 1609, the Dutch arrived in Japan with Ieyasu's approval to officially break the Portuguese monopoly on Japanese trade. And the Dutch were closely followed by the Protestant English too, who arrived in 1613 to establish trade there with the Japanese as well, again with Ieyasu's approval. Interestingly, however, after 13 years of living in Japan, Adams seems to have been quite uneasy around his old countrymen when they finally turned up. He didn't mind the idea of opening up the Japanese market to the English, but he didn't seem to like the English people who rocked up. The English who met him commented on how he seemed more Japanese than English these days, speaking the language, wearing the clothes, observing all the customs. Adams wouldn't remain behind in the English headquarters, although he did accept a post there under the pay of the English East India Company, drawing a second salary on top of his remuneration as a servant of the Shogun. So that's very smart from Adams. That's smart stuff from him, mate. That's double jobbing. He was on that hustle 400 years ago. But honestly, the English, they didn't make the most of their position in Japan. They only sent a handful of vessels. They didn't make all that much money from the voyages. They did bring back some quite interesting gifts. Even today, the Tower of London displays one of the suits of armour given to the English in 1603, a gift from the Tokugawa Shogunate to the English crown. But the one thing that the English didn't bring back was Adams himself. Adams approached Ieyasu once again in 1613 and asked for and received permission to leave Japan, to return to England, but ultimately he decided not to go. He, as I say, didn't seem to think too much of the Englishmen who had arrived to set up shop in Japan, and after 13 years in his new home, he didn't seem to be in a hurry to leave, even though he could now. His poor wife and kids back in England. I mean, at least he was keeping up his child support payments, I suppose. He did continue to send money back to them via European vessels that visited, but he never saw them again. He never returned to England in his entire life. After arriving on the shores of Japan in 1600, he never once went back to Europe. He did actually leave Japan, though, later on, between 1614 and 1618. Adams organized and took part in various voyages around Asia in an attempt to establish trade links for the English East India Company throughout the region. He sailed to Siam, Thailand today, in 1614, and then again in 1615, and then sailed to Vietnam in 1617 and 1618. And in both places, he attempted to establish an English commercial presence, But broadly speaking, these attempts didn't come to all that much in the long term. And moreover, the English withdrew from Japan altogether by 1623 in the time leading up to the beginning of Japan's isolationist Sokoku period. So in the end, it was actually the Dutch who were the real winners. Even when Japan completely closed its borders and markets to the rest of the world by the 1630s, the Dutch remained behind as the only trading link the Japanese had with regions like Europe. And this is another of Adam's legacies, perhaps one of his most important ones. It was he that first helped to establish the Dutch East India Company in Japan, helped the Dutch to gain their foothold in the Japanese market in the first place. And for hundreds of years, the Dutch were the only link that the rest of the European region had with the Japanese. Anyway, after returning from his 1615 voyage to Siam, Adams returned to find that his patron Iyasu had died and that his son Hidetada had taken the reins from his old man. And while Hidetada reaffirmed Adams' position as a Hatamoto and continued to support English and Dutch trading rights in Japan, this marked a significant shift in Adams' political career. It swiftly wound down as power passed from father to son. Adams had a close relationship with Iyasu, and that had made him one of the most important political advisors in the country. But now, with a new generation of political leadership and with more Europeans than ever before in Japan, Adams just wasn't as essential as he once had been. He continued with his voyages, traveling, as I say, to Vietnam, but sadly, in 1620, at the age of just 55, William Adams, Mira Anjin, he died, never having returned to his native England after leaving it 2 decades beforehand. His wealth was divided between his two families in England and Japan, while his Japanese son inherited his title and his estate and continued to sail on behalf of the English until they finally departed, as I say, in 1623. And then he sailed for the Dutch after that. However, Japan was to enter into a new chapter of its history in the years that followed. After all the work that Iyasu and Adams had done in opening up the country and its markets to the world, the Sokoku period was looming on the horizon. In 1635, Tokugawa Iemitsu, Iyasu's grandson, he proclaimed the Sokoku Edict, which sought to remove any foreign presence, or culture, or ideas, or influence from Japan. Foreigners were forced to leave. Foreign trade was almost completely eliminated. As I say, only the Dutch maintained a few small trading outposts. And the Japanese themselves were forbidden from departing Japan. This isolationist policy remained in place for over 200 years. A fully isolationist Japan refusing any and all attempts to be ingratiated into the international community and its markets until, that is, American Commodore Matthew Perry arrived on Japan's shores in 1854 and suggested most politely to the Japanese that perhaps they should open back up to the world. And Commodore Perry added some strength to this argument he made by pointing out the marvelously powerful cannons that bristled from the warships that he'd brought with him. And so Japan's markets opened once more, just as they had done when the Portuguese had arrived in the 16th century, and then again with the arrival of William Adams in 1600. Shogun, the TV show, as entertainment media, exists to tell an engaging and an interesting story. And as fiction, it has the freedom to shape and to sculpt that story for it to be as enjoyable as possible to those who are hearing it. We don't have the same luxury with history, however. And I think it's true to say that the fictional representation of the fictional John Blackthorne is a lot more dynamic and engaging than the real history of the real William Adams. But all the same, I still really like Shogun. It is historical fiction, but it's historical fiction done right. It's not dressed up as the truth. It's not attempting to sell you some inaccurate perspective on real historical figures. And honestly, even if Adams' story isn't as exciting as, you know, a story specifically written to be exciting, it's still very important. As the first Englishman to reach Japan, as one of the first Western samurai, as someone who had the ear of the most powerful man in Japan, as someone who helped to shape the foreign policy of the Tokugawa shogunate for over a decade, as someone who opened up the Japanese market like never before, Adams' story is certainly one worth telling and one worth enjoying. And even knowing now how things panned out in the real world of history, I'm glad that his story is being remixed and retold on the screen, and I hope that a great many other people's stories are told in the same way. But that's it. That's all she wrote today, sports fans. That is the story of William Adams, and hopefully should give you some background and some perspective and some insight as to what's on your screen when you're watching Shogun. Again, apologies to anyone who doesn't have any interest in the show or wouldn't watch it anyway. Hopefully this episode stands on its own legs even without all the references to the TV show. But I'd give it a crack. Honestly, I'd give the show a go. It's pretty good and well worth your time, I think. But I want to close out the show here with a couple of things, and I do have two announcements to make, but before we do that boring housekeeping stuff, such as thanking all the new listeners who have come in this week. I know many people will be listening to the show for the first time after having, you know, maybe looked up, trying to find some new information, some details about the TV show Shogun. Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, I did mention some of the other episodes that you can check out, most notably, of course, episodes 230, 231, 232, which will talk more about Nobunaga, Hideyoshi, and Ieyasu, give you even more of an insight as to this period of Japanese history. But plenty of other stuff, and if you're looking for a starting point, you want to sort of figure out what the show is all about, have a look in the show description, where you'll find links to some of the better episodes that I've done, some of the funnier or the sillier or even, honestly, just the more, you know, informative episodes. Have a listen to them. See if you like it. And if you do, the good news is nearly 300 episodes more for you to get across, in addition to the other shorter form episodes that come out this week. I want to thank the people who got in touch, of course, to suggest this as a topic. I greatly enjoyed doing it. Maybe there's other TV shows as well, other bits of popular media that I should talk about from a historical perspective. So thanks once again, Tom Austin, Javier Gonzalez-Sanchez, Emil Neufeld, and also David Schultz and Alyssa as well, who were keen on some Japanese history. I want to thank the alert Patreons who have signed up this week. We've got a new batch of them who have signed up at patreon.com/halfasshistory. Jonathan Bollinger, John Hooter, Katie, Owen Quill, Alex, and I'm very pleased to see that Magnus Walgren upped their contribution, up their pledge this week. So thanks very much, Magnus. If you want to join the exalted ranks of the Patreon hordes, you certainly can. Patreon.com/halfasshistory. And as I say, you'll gain access to all sorts of bonus materials, uncut episodes where you can listen to me mispronounce words and get frustrated at stuffing up lines, and I leave all the burps and the farts and stuff in as well. So if you've got an interest in that, you can have a listen to that. Also, early access to shows, show notes, and exclusive patron-only merch. And of course, ad-free listening available on Patreon if you head over there. But now, my friends, I want to share something, two things with you. First of all, next week's episode is episode 300. And last week I asked for suggestions, and oh boy, did I get some? I got a whole bunch of people suggesting what I should do to mark this occasion, and it was amazing just how many people, seemingly independently, suggested the same thing. So if you're one of those people who got in touch to make a certain suggestion, you'll be very pleased to know that it's going to be a tricky one to tackle next week. But because it was something that I was thinking, oh, maybe I should do this anyway. And then all these people got in touch to suggest the same topic. And I was like, oh boy, don't have an excuse now. Everyone's thinking it. So it's time for it. So tune in next week for a long awaited topic that many, many, many people have suggested. It isn't the East India Company. I'll make it clear. I'll get there eventually, right? I'll do it eventually. That and the French Revolution, we'll get there one day. But the second thing I want to tease you with here, make sure you come back for that big episode 300, is that next week, it's not just episode 300, I will be launching something that I have been putting off and putting off for so, so long. I do not want to do this thing, but I've been told by so many people, by the team at Acast, the people who host the show, by my agent, by countless listeners writing in as well, by my friends, by my fiance, everyone thinks I should do this thing. I do not want to do it. But it's happening, whether I like it or not. Well, I don't like it. It's definitely or not in my case. But look forward to a brand new chapter in the content offerings of Half-Assed History. It's not a new episode. It's not the book. It's not the merch. I wonder if you can figure it out. There you go. You got a week to figure out what it's going to be. Why am I dreading this this new direction that the podcast is going to take? You will all will be revealed in 1 week. I don't do these sorts of teasers every often, but hey, listen, it's episode 300, right? I get to do a tease every now and again. Okay, all right, just as a little treat for me. Anyway, be sure to tune in next week. We've got a ripper episode coming your way, and the grand reveal of this thing that I am absolutely dreading. We'll see how I enjoy getting it started up in the next 7 days, getting it ready for everyone's enjoyment for episode 300. But until then, of course, tell your friends, tell your enemies, tell people about whom you feel largely ambivalent. If you've got friends or enemies or people you feel ambivalent about who are watching Shogun, who've been talking your ear off about the show, who want maybe some more information about it, be sure to send this episode over to them. If there's anyone in your life that you know is a fan of this sort of stuff, make sure you help them get across it, because I had a great time. I had a really, really good time putting this episode together. I hope you enjoyed it half as much as I did while I was making it. And if you've got other suggestions, of course, halfasthistory.net, use the contact form there. Other TV shows, other pieces of popular media, or just anything else that you think would be a good fit for the show, be sure to get in touch and send through those guesses as to what you think the big announcement next week is going to be. Anyway, that is that. Leaving you, of course, with a question posed on Reddit. This one comes to us from Papa Huggies, quite the name. And Papa Huggies asks, if Japan has the highest life expectancy in the world, why doesn't everyone just move there when they get old?
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.